Hello and welcome to the Tribcast from the Texas Tribune. My name is Elise Hugh, political reporter at the Tribune, joined by CEO and editor-in-chief Evan Smith.
Good morning.
Managing editor Ross Ramsey.
Hello.
And Ben Philpott, who is covering the governor's race for KUT and the Texas Tribune. Each week, every podcaster brings a topic to the table. This week, we're talking the RGA, Dick Cheney's visit to Texas, Brian McCall, and money and politics. Ben, we'll start with your topic first.
Well, Elise, I'm heading off here in just a couple hours to go check out the Republican Governors Association. It's going to be an interesting time. You know, the biggest movers and shakers in the Republican Party, maybe minus Sarah Palin, will be in town. And, it'll be interesting to see who or what comes out of the meetings and what kind of setup some of these people have for the presidential run that you would expect some of them to. I mean, if you've got eight people, if you assume maybe eight people will announce that they're going to be Republican presidential candidates in 2012, I would guess four or five of them will be in the room at this event.
You're thinking Pawlenty?
Yes.
Haley Barbour?
Yes.
Rick Perry?
Possibly.
That's a trick question.
Yeah.
But the fact is, many of the people who have been mentioned right now to be candidates for the next race, Sarah Palin, no longer a governor, famously.
Right.
Mitt Romney, no longer a governor. Mike Huckabee, no longer a governor. So I'm just wondering who else in that august group might step forward here.
Jindal's a national figure probably from Louisiana.
I forgot about Bobby. I think what happened with Bobby Jindal is he had that
famously crashed.
He did that face plant after the State of the Union, but I guess people still say Jindal is a force to be reckoned with.
You know,
right?
Bill Clinton started with a face plant. He did a famous speech at the Democratic National Convention where the biggest applause line was in closing, and people went into applause. He went on Johnny Carson. Remember Johnny Carson, kids? And he went on Johnny Carson the next night and ate crow in front of a national audience. But, you know, a faceplant doesn't necessarily kill you.
I just think it's interesting to imagine that of the group that's in attendance, you know, the idea that Haley Barbour might be president one day. Haley Barbour was, in addition to being a successful governor of Mississippi, was the head of the Republican Party, right? And he was a lobbyist, was he not?
Right. Sounds like George H.W. Bush.
And Haley Barbour actually... It's interesting you bring up George H.W. Bush because Haley Barbour is one of these Republicans, even though he does hail from the South and is seen as very socially conservative, he's trying to be big tent again. You know, he's fascinating because he's talking about how, you know, Republicans shouldn't squeeze out those that are considered more moderate or fiscal conservatives in favor of social conservatives. So that's his big message, which I think is interesting to watch as they're in Texas this week.
And Ben, he was quite good during Katrina, was he not?
Haley Barbour?
Yeah.
Better than Louisiana. I mean, you know,
is that the reference point now?
Because I think that when you're talking about Katrina, yeah, that's the bar. You know, did you perform better than Louisiana? Governor Perry looked exceptional during Katrina and bringing everyone into Houston. I think Haley Barbour looked good in Mississippi. Governor Riley in Alabama, you know, looked fine there. And then you had Louisiana, so.
Well, that's kind of where Bill White rose to prominence, too. The mayor of Houston is now running maybe, if for U.S. Senate.
Well, I want to get back on this Perry thing, Ben, while we have the opportunity to tee this up, because, of course, Paul Burka of Texas Monthly, who I know a little bit,
right.
But not only Paul, has mentioned that there may be a move afoot for Rick Perry to enter the presidential race, whether it's Perry pushing it or Perry's people pushing it or people who view Perry as a good-looking, reliable conservative, relatively untainted in the way that many people who are considering running next time are tainted. Huckabee, Romney, and Palin for having run unsuccessfully in the last round. Palin, obviously, is vice president. Gingrich for all of his various Gingrichness that, you know, becomes a problem for him as a national candidate. And so people look at Rick Perry and they think, why not? So my question to you and to you, Ross, is, well, why not have Rick Perry on the list of potential candidates for the next election? Maybe Burke is right in that respect.
Well, it's also something for, you know, being a political writer myself, it's also something to do the week before Thanksgiving when politics gets a little bit slow. You know, we're far enough in front of 2012 that we're kind of at the fat end of the funnel. You know, where everybody's a possible candidate. And we'll go through this process over the next two or three or four years where we take people out of the running. Rick Perry in 49 states is a relatively fresh face. He's a good-looking guy. He's a very good campaigner. He is politically focused, in a way that some of these people aren't focused. And he's at this particular moment, he's positioned himself as one of the stronger voices against an Obama administration that at this second in the South anyway, is kind of unpopular. So he's positioned right now, whether he's actually doing this with presidential aspirations or not. I mean, you know, he's doing all the things you would have to do. Whether he's actually interested in this, thinking about this, running for this, I mean, that's only in the mind of Rick Perry, right?
And I think it's amazing that he's able to play both sides of the Republican Party right now. I mean, he's one of the few Republicans that can go to a Tea Party and not be booed. And he turns around and goes to Chamber of Commerce things and gets standing ovations for the pro-business climate that he's made in the state.
The relative economic health of Texas right. compared to other states. And if you think about it, part of the reason why Perry is strong in a primary against Hutchison is why Perry would be strong in a primary against a field of potentially more moderate right. Republicans, because who comes out to vote in a presidential primary? The base. Perry is quite strong with the base, no question about that. His base bona fides are without question. I come back to this. Why not Perry? Why has Perry's flirting with secession? Why is Perry's flirting with invoking the 10th Amendment against Obama's health care plan? Why has Perry's relentless attacks on Washington not been fodder for a potential presidential campaign? Mm-hmm. Hard to argue.
As we talk about the Republican establishment, that kind of brings us to my topic, which is Dick Cheney. He was in Houston on Tuesday night to, I guess, formally endorse Kay Bailey Hutchison for governor, and I can't really decide how much I care.
It's kind of fun to have him back in Texas. We can report that no Austin parking garage magnates were harmed in the making of this endorsement, right?
I just can't decide. I guess he obviously helps raise money. It was up to $5,000 to go to the event in Houston last night, the fundraising event. And then who's more conservative than Dick Cheney? So I assume that would kind of help her conservative credentials. But how much does Dick Cheney actually move the needle? I don't know.
There are two kinds of primaries, two kinds of elections. The first election, you know, that everybody knows about is the one where everybody goes to the polls and votes. And so you try to get voters and make yourself popular with those voters and they support you. And the other one that precedes that election and actually then parallels it is the race for money. Dick Cheney, when you're going around to fundraisers as they did after this appearance in Houston, you're going around to fundraisers and those kinds of things, Dick Cheney is the kind of name that brings out the kind of people who contribute to gubernatorial nominations. I think, you know, part of the endorsement here is telling all the money people that Kay is his candidate. One of the things that, you know, comes from the RGA thing, one of the things we'll find out with all of these governors in Texas is how many of them are actually basing themselves in Bastrop, where they're having this Republican Governors Association thing, and while they're at it, meeting prospective Republican Texas donors who would fund a national race. I mean, there's two things going on here.
Well, to the question of does this move the needle, you know, what's the big difference? You know, maybe that it doesn't move the needle. I don't think it moves the needle now. I mean, the people paying attention now are the activists. We've had two polls in a row that show that Perry has a double-digit lead with the activists that are paying attention right now. But so where does it move the needle? Maybe it moves the needle, as you said, in terms of he brings in money. That money then gets spent 1st of January when more people are paying attention, and maybe then it moves the needle. But it sounds like it's just a little blurb now, and that's it.
I question whether Vice President Cheney's popularity in Texas is sufficiently high that his association with Senator Hutchison has an impact in the kind of broad landscape of voters. But I do think that, you know, where Senator Hutchison has a potential weak spot is that she is perceived fairly or unfairly as a moderate. And moderate is a four-letter word in a Republican primary, at least right now, in this state. And so when Cheney shows up in Houston, as he did last night, and he says basically there are real conservatives and there are fakes, she's a real, that's a telegraph to the base, she's cool. She has my voucher. And I think that there is something significant about that, but I want to underscore, I just don't know that Dick Cheney, as a force, he doesn't necessarily matter. Now, there's the rumor is that although George W. Bush is staying out of this race, that he's for her. It might be the only thing that Bush and Cheney have agreed on in the last year, right? But the theory is that Bush is for her. I think it comes back to this very interesting thing about the Bushies seeming to be with her, which makes you wonder what kind of a relationship Bush and Perry had or have, and what relationship the Bushies and the Perry people had or have. Again, Karen Hughes, Karl Rove, rumored to be Vice President Bush, now Vice President Cheney. I think we asked Dan Bartlett a couple weeks ago, tell me one Bushy who's for Perry. You know, people associated at that level with Bush, and it's hard. He's hard pressed to name one. I'm sure there are some, but it's difficult. And I think the subtext is in some ways more interesting than the endorsement.
And Perry may not want the support of any Bushies or Bush administration officials anyway, since they are symbolic of Washington, which he's running against. So
and big spending.
Exactly.
Right?
So it probably doesn't help Perry at all anyway.
Exactly so.
Our next topic is from Ross on state lawmaker Brian McCall of Plano.
Yeah, this was sort of an interesting thing. Brian McCall has been in the Texas House, will have been in the Texas House at the end of this term for 20 years. He told me he works in 20-year cycles. He sold his business after 20 years. He's quitting this after 20 years. There had been a lot of speculation about him. Was he going to run for state senate? Florence Shapiro, his state senator, is one of the people who would like to run for Kay Hutchison's U.S. Senate seat. Sam Johnson, who's his congressman, is rumored every 2 years to be retiring this time. Brian says he's not interested in either one of those things, that really he's interested in moving on. There have been some rumors about him going into another state job, maybe a university position, something like that. We'll see how those pan out. But he kind of surprised everybody. He's been a player in the House for all of these years without ever becoming a chairman until this last session. He was one of the 11 Republicans who helped Joe Strauss become the speaker and overthrow Tom Craddock. He was rewarded with the chair of calendars, which sets the agenda in the House. It's one of the two or three most powerful committees. And after, you know, one run with that and walking out smiling, he says he wants to leave on top. So kind of surprised everybody.
But if you've ever been chair of calendars in the Texas House, doesn't this pretty much guarantee a pretty lucrative lobbying career?
Yeah, I don't think, I would be surprised if Brian McCall became a lobbyist. But if he wanted to become a lobbyist, he is perfectly situated to do so, but it would surprise me. He made a personal fortune in the insurance business, so he's set financially. I think he loves politics. I think he loves policy. I'm not sure he likes the idea of sitting outside of a committee hearing at 9:30 at night on a Tuesday, you know, waiting for somebody to burp out an amendment he wants.
And we should mention that Congressman Sam Johnson is in the Delwyn Jones age demographic. So that probably explains why he's been wanting to, or he's been rumored to be retiring soon for many years.
And Brian McCall is in the Delwyn Jones ideological demographic in the sense that Brian McCall has been a target from the right as often or more often than from the left. Remember that Tom Craddock wasn't a big fan as speaker of Brian McCall. There was a persistent sense that Brian McCall's electoral health was consistently being undermined by people to the right of Brian McCall. The reality is that Brian McCall is a more moderate, whether he would describe himself as moderate per se, he's a more moderate Republican than a lot of members of the House. And I think that probably put him in a difficult position with a lot of his colleagues over time. And it's yet another, I think we've had Farabee, we have Hobson switching, right, and the threat from Michael Banks to the right of Hobson. Let's assume Hobson got picked off by Banks. That's probably a Republican district safely. Farabee is going to be replaced by a conservative Republican.
Right, the mayor of Wichita Falls.
Mayor of Wichita Falls. And then if McCall's seat becomes an ideological war between the rightmost elements of the Republican Party and the more moderate elements, and the rightmost elements win, that's three seats that theoretically flip to the anti-Strauss camp.
I don't know if they're so strongly anti-Strauss. They would have been in the other, 2 years ago, those would have been Craddock votes probably.
Right.
You know, you've got this kind of interesting thing. If you're in the part of the Republican Party that's not winning in the House right now, let's just, I don't know if I want to call them more conservative or just different, but let's just say you're in that part of the party, the place where you claw your way back is in Republican primaries, and you win with your kind of Republicans, you get enough of those, and you can overcome the Democrats, and bada bing, bada boom. That's what you would be saying in your war council, and that's what we'll either see or not see when candidates start filing for office in, 2 weeks at the beginning of December. They file from early December until January 4th. So we'll start to see this form. And as Evan says, we'll see it form in the Hobson seat. I think it's already done in the Farabee seat. We'll see it form in the McCall seat and maybe in some other challenges for Republicans along the way. Brian McCall, we should say, is one of the people who early on warned against a Craddock speakership, very early on, and that's why he was on the outs with Craddock. And then 2 years ago was one of two Republicans. Jim Pitts was the other one who actually mounted challenges to Craddock. McCall got all the way to the door and didn't come in. Pitts lost on the floor of the House. 2 years later, Joe Strauss won with Pitts and McCall in his corner. So clearly part of the Republican insurgency. And, you know, a sidebar on this, he's one of the genuinely civil people in the Texas House and in the legislature. He's one of those people that, when you know, he's managed all of those 20 years to agree and disagree with people and still keep them as friends, which is something of a hat trick, and we ought to, you know, nod to that.
Ben, I'm wondering if you think that as you look at the legislature and the likelihood of the Republicans maintaining or increasing their majority as a result of the 2010 elections, do you foresee trouble on the horizon for Strauss? If Strauss wants to, as he said, you know, wants to be Speaker again, he announced a certain number of pledges at the conclusion of the 09 session, but the, you know, July of 09 to January of 11 is an eternity in politics, especially in Texas. And the fact is, you know, although Speaker Craddock denies any desire to return to that chair, his designee, whoever that designee might be, might very well like to challenge Joe Strauss from the right in the speaker's race. Does the McCall decision effectively kick off a speaker's race, do you think?
Gosh, you know, I don't know. I mean,
we need a cricket sound we can superimpose there.
It makes it all closer. I mean, it helps us to maybe be able to promote a fight, as you like to say, in the next legislative, at the beginning of the next legislative session. I think that, you know, it might depend on the designee. I mean, you had the Craddock D's who kind of stuck until the very end and then jumped over.
Describe what those are.
Craddock Democrats, Democrats who gave their pledges to Tom Craddock when he was the speaker and then therefore were on his leadership team and got either committee chairmanships or vice chairmanships.
And were protected, frankly, right, at election time, whether overtly or less so.
Except from Democrats. The Democrats went in and started taking
right,
them
the Democrats
out.
Started to try and take them off. But
protected from Republicans.
You know, those Craddock D's, they stuck with them till the very end, then switched over, and Democrats, you know, kind of came together en masse there at the end to support Joe Strauss. But, you know, depending on who the designee is, there's a chance that they could pick a designee that even the former Craddock D's just can't handle, is not palatable to them, and they might stick together with a Strauss. But I don't know.
I don't really see a race this time. I think this may be, as you do with all speakerships, you look back at the very beginning of the insurrection and, you know, well, this really started 8 years ago, and, you know, we may be talking about this then. I think Strauss is going to have a couple of advantages this time. The fastest way to reunite the Democrats who are sort of normally fractious, the fastest way to reunite those guys is to show up with a conservative Republican as a speaker candidate. Bang, you've got a solid block of Democrats. The second thing here is Strauss is going to be in a position, because of the Farabee retirement and because of the Hobson flip, he may very well be in the position of saying, I'm the guy who reversed the trend of losing Republican seats in the House, and I think that's going to be strong among. And then the last piece of that is that the Republicans outside the House aren't clamoring for any change here. So they're all going to, institutionally, the Republican Party is going to back him, you know, at least this time.
We've saved our media's topic for last and for Evan. Evan, introduce your topic for us.
Well, I'm really interested in the idea of money in politics, which has been very much on our minds this week as a result of a conference that took place at the University of Texas campus on Monday and a poll that was released in connection with that conference showing that Americans, by significant numbers, are not so much concerned about the amount of money in politics, they're more concerned about the source of it. This news comes something of a surprise to me because we keep being told how there's too much money in politics, and that we need to do something about that, as opposed to it's okay to have as much money as you want provided that there's transparency and that the money's clean and, you know, we don't believe that there's influence being peddled or you know, donors soliciting recipients of money soliciting that money on the, you know, in exchange for something untoward. It's an interesting conversation to have right now because of the various races going on in Texas. You know, Governor Perry and Senator Hutchison will not lack for money in this race. They may end up spending $20 million each by the time this primary is over to win an office that is famously described as, quote, weak. And, you know, in doing so, they may not change the dynamic. Remember that, you know, we've had gubernatorial candidates spend quite a bit more than that over the last couple of years. But
I think there was a guy who spent like $70 million and lost?
He spent $70 million to get the same percentage of the vote that Marty Akins got spending $1
million,
in 2002. This would be Tony Sanchez. But the fact is that we've had money in politics at this level or at a greater level before, but we're going to have a lot of money spent in a governor's race. There's talk about Lieutenant Governor Dewhurst getting into a Senate race that may or may not happen ever or soon or who knows what, but using his own personal wealth to essentially overwhelm the other candidates, Democrat and Republican, in that field. On the Democratic side of that Senate race, you've got this interesting dynamic between John Sharp and Bill White, where both has raised a lot of money as reported, but in White's case it means actually raised. In Sharp's case, it really means loaned to myself. And then back in the governor's race, you had Farouk Shami, the hair care entrepreneur from Houston, pledging to spend $10 million of his own money on a Democratic nomination that may ultimately not be worth a half-open bottle of shampoo when you consider the fact that the state is not ready to elect a Democrat, or at least has shown very little signs of it. And so Shami could spend all of his money to get the same 38% of the vote that a Chris Bell or a Gary Morrow or a, you know, fill-in-the-blank might get. So my question to all of you is, you know, is the issue of money in politics one that is particularly germane to us right now, or are Americans right not to be concerned about the amount, and rather we should just be sure that the money comes from good places?
Yeah, I think they're worried about the provenance of money. They're clearly, you know, they said in this poll, and, you know, we've seen over the years that, you know, if money comes from particular sources that the public finds particularly great or particularly awful, that the public reacts to that. But Texas politics is a great example of, you know, you can put a ton of money in a race and people don't necessarily react to that. I mean, you know, if the money comes from what voters consider one way or another a relatively clean source, say the candidate themselves, then it's not really an issue. Clady Williams spent a pile of money becoming a Republican gubernatorial candidate. Tony Sanchez spent a pile of money. And the money wasn't really so much the interest in those races as it is when someone shows up who's got a, you know, an axe to grind, shows up backing a candidate, you know, that becomes an issue for that candidate.
And I could totally make an argument for money in politics because it is expensive to get your message out. I mean, it costs $1 million a week to advertise on television across, or more than $1 million a week. Ross is giving me the thumbs up.
Yeah, about $1.8 million for 500 points.
Right, so that's, you know, 21 television markets across the state. It can help get your message out and then get people to the polls, too. City of Austin, for example, has campaign contribution limits that the state of Texas does not. Those campaign contribution limits are what, at $300?
Something like that. And there's been a study by ACC, Austin Community College, in the last year or so that has shown participation in the Austin municipal elections has dropped since they added that cap in.
Turnout's at 10% or something.
Oh,
or less.
6%, yeah.
So
But there can be
an argument. I'm just
I don't disagree with you. It's expensive to run in politics, which is both the argument for money and the argument against money in this respect. The incumbency protection program that is currently in place in this state has really three aspects to it. The first is redistricting, which is forced ideological harmony within districts to the degree that although there are 150 House seats up every 2 years, for instance, there are maybe 10 to 15 that are competitive at most. The second reason is that the press has basically stopped covering a lot of stuff that goes on at the legislature and stopped covering the activities or lack thereof of members. So back home, people have nothing to base their decisions on. And if you're going to fire the incumbent, you got to have a reason. So I'd argue that that's a second reason. But a third reason is that it is just simply expensive if you're a challenger without personal wealth to mount a successful campaign against somebody who has access to money. And so if you want to democratize democracy, one argument goes, you have to figure out a way to level the playing field so that the average person who's not a rich guy or inherited money from a previous generation or whatever, you got to give that person the same access to the airwaves, the same access to the voters. This is a very big and difficult state to run in. So if you're a candidate for governor, say, and Ross's and your, Elise's, numbers are correct, and it costs roughly $1.8 million a week to advertise across the state. If you're a statewide candidate for office, you've got to figure out where you're going to get that money from if you want to have half a chance of being competitive. We would not be talking about Farouk Shami, but for his $10 million. Without Farouk Shami's $10 million, he's Gene Kelly. He's any number of of people who showed up, never heard of him and never will hear of him again, who's run for statewide office. He's Felix Alvarado.
So then,
without that money,
does
right?
that point to us, the press, as not being, you know, good stewards of the public interest by covering the Felix Alvarados better?
No, I mean it doesn't. It doesn't. You know, one of the things they said in this poll that the LBJ School did, Center for Politics and Governance. I was calling it Politics and Government earlier this week.
And they slapped your hand.
Well, apparently it happens to them all the time.
Right.
It's Center for Politics and Governance. Yeah. Anyway, you know, one of the things that people said in this was that they would support public funding for elections. Now, when you pose the question differently, as they did not in this poll, but as they have in other polls, would you agree that some of your tax money should go to elections? People go, what are you, nuts? So, I mean, people understand the need for fairness in this thing. It's fraught with problems. I mean, one of the things is, you know, how do you determine who's a serious candidate? How do you keep is there a bozo filter on the federal public money, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera? One place, if you sort of return to the first part of this, judicial candidates in Texas observe campaign finance limits. They have a hard time raising money. Some of them run statewide. They rarely raise more than $1 million for a campaign, and as you can see from our math, that's 3 days of TV. So they usually don't do much TV. They don't get hit for the amount of money they take. They get hit for taking money from people who practice before the courts. It's like a standard line. So it's not that you are a judge who took a bunch of money from so-and-so. It's that you are a judge who took money from Baker and Botts or Fulbright and Jaworski or for something like that. And they're constantly fighting against kind of the provenance of the money, where the money comes from, rather than the amount.
We'll continue this skirmish off mic, likely. But for now, I'm Elise Hugh. On behalf of Evan Smith, Ross Ramsey, and Ben Philpott, thank you for listening.